from Illinois Public Media. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Because pregnant women are at an increased risk for contracting severe COVID, vaccinations are especially important for this group. Not to mention the risk to pregnancy outcomes and complications due to COVID are also disproportionately high. Despite overwhelming medical evidence pointing to the safety and necessity of vaccines for pregnant women, fears over fertility and fetal issues have prevented many people from taking them. Some men have even grown wary it could alter their sperm production. Though the vaccine presents no risk of infertility, research has now confirmed that the shots can affect menstrual cycles, linking vaccination to a slight increase in the length of a cycle. Joining us now are two researchers who documented this particular effect and others in an open-ended research study. Kate Clancy is a human reproductive ecologist and associate professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois. She studied how environmental stressors influence period for 20 years. Dr. Clancy, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also joining us is Catherine Lee, biological anthropologist and postdoctoral scholar in the Division of Public Health Sciences at Washington University School of Medicine. Dr. Lee, welcome to the 21st to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And to dispel falsities and help us answer questions surrounding reproductive health and COVID is also with us is Dr. Alessandra Hirsch, resident physician in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Chicago Medical Center. She's also an activist and public health opinion writer. Dr. Hirsch, welcome to the 21st to you as well.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
Listeners, as always, we welcome your calls. If you have questions about reproductive health and COVID, we want to know, was your menstrual cycle affected by the vaccine? Perhaps join the conversation by giving us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21st Show. All right. So, Dr. Clancy, a lot has developed since the last time we had you on in April to discuss menstrual side effects post-vaccination. What did we know then? How have things changed? What do we know now?
Gosh, what did we know then versus now? We do certainly seem to have a couple of different studies now that are showing, at least among some individuals who've had vaccine, that they are experiencing some changes to their menstrual cycle. I don't know how else to answer that question, to be totally honest.
Sure,
the main difference is just that we have a few more studies now than we had before. But I will say, I think the more important point here is that a lot of people, cycling people and postmenopausal people and people on gender-affirming hormones have known about it for a full year. It's just taken that long for the research to catch up because of the fact that vaccine trial design didn't allow for this to be studied in the first place. So, you know, this knowledge has been here the whole time. People have had this lived experience. We don't always need, a scientific paper to confirm a lived experience when we have tens or even hundreds of thousands of people with an experience.
Sure. And Dr. Lee, you and Dr. Clancy have collected more than 140,000 reports from people who say they've noticed a change in their periods after vaccination. Can you tell us about your research and how you came to be involved?
Well, first I want to say we have around 165,000 people who responded to our survey either in English or in Spanish. Not all of them are reporting changes, though. We had the survey set up so that people could report if they had any changes, but they could also participate to say, hey, I didn't have any changes, which we thought was important. So we could look at any sort of trends and who does see changes versus who does not see changes or what types of changes people might be seeing. So I think that's really important. It's not like we only sought out one particular type of response. What we asked was, hey, what did you experience? So that we could actually interpret what was happening in this total dearth of evidence, like that Dr. Clancy mentioned, where there was no information existing until we started collecting this other than in social media reports.
So what are you seeing patterns among the respondents who said that they did notice a change in their periods?
So we have a study that is currently in review. And in general, we are seeing a few trends, but I'm not sure how much I'll defer to Dr. Clancy as the more senior author in terms of how much to say about our study here versus before it's fully peer-reviewed and released.
Right. And that's a great caveat. So preprint status, I guess, is what you say.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, and maybe Dr. Clancy, if you want to weigh in, I mean, what, you know, pending peer review, what are you finding what are the preliminarily, what are the results of your work?
So we've had the preprint out since October. It has gone on through one round of peer review and we've gotten comments back. We've addressed those comments and resubmitted the manuscript just in the last week. And I will say that the contents of the findings are unchanged from the initial preprint. So you can look at the preprint and see that the findings are going to be, you know, unless this next round tells us to do another round of analyses, the findings will be the same. And I would say the most important thing to observe here, more so than what are the trends among the people who did have changes, because again, I would really love to see those reported after we've gone through and been accepted through the peer review process, is just for now, I think the most important thing is that what our study did that no study has done to this point is make sure, one, to, as Dr. Lee said, inquire about whether there's been any experience, and including no experience at all. The other is that we were very intentional in our inclusive language to make sure that anybody who has ever menstruated can participate, which is why we have a really decent sample size for postmenopausal people, as well as people who are gender diverse. And on gender-affirming hormone treatments, for instance, or long-acting reversible contraceptives, or for any other reason are not currently menstruating. And what that has allowed us to do is ask not just about regularly cycling people, but people who've cycled in the past. And so we have revealed that a significant proportion of those people within our sample have experienced breakthrough bleeding. Because it's a convenient sample, we can't say how perfectly this extends to the broader population, but we can say that we see a really significant number. 71% of people on long-acting reversible contraceptives had breakthrough bleeding, meaning they had not been menstruating for some number of months or even years, and then suddenly had a period after the vaccine. Though, again, the other thing that I'll point out with our research is that while what we're looking at right now is short term and we're in the middle of a follow-up study to get a sense of, you know, how long this renormalization happens, for the most part, among the small number of respondents, you know, in some of our other groups, to have this experience appears to be pretty short term. And I think that that's important to notice, just because this is what you would expect from an immune response from a vaccine, is that it's going to affect all sorts of immune organs, but that effect can and should be short term. And if anything, as unpleasant as it was, as someone who did have that experience of a very heavy period after my first dose, I can say that it was, you know, it's an expected thing to have these things happen, and that as unpleasant as it is short lived.
Okay, there's a lot to get into here, and I want to come back to this idea of that you hinted at earlier, is why weren't these being studied from the get-go in the clinical trials? And I know that animated a lot of our conversation last time, but I want to bring Dr. Alessandra Hirsch into the conversation. Now, you're a resident in obstetrics and gynecology at UChicago. I wonder if you're hearing concerns about these, you know, menstrual effects after post-vaccination from any of your patients or colleagues and their patients.
Sure. You know, most of my patients at this point are pregnant and have a lot of questions about how the vaccine might affect their fertility or their pregnancy outcomes. And a lot of the hesitancy regarding the vaccine surrounds that. I think my patients who are planning to get pregnant have questions where their menstrual cycles relate to their ability to get pregnant. And it's sort of a very closely tied thing for them. So the good news is that we do have pretty good data that the vaccine doesn't affect fertility, doesn't affect egg quality or embryo quality, doesn't increase your likelihood of having a miscarriage. So the good news is that I can tell my patients that. The takeaway that I'm getting from this research, though, is that it's important to listen to our patients. You know, you're alluding to the fact that this research wasn't included in the initial vaccine studies, which I think doesn't surprise anybody who knows about drug development or the history of research in this and other countries. Women and, you know, sort of what affects women's bodies is often left out. And so it's really important as a clinician to listen to and honor my patients' specific concerns, especially when it comes to things that have been previously ignored by the medical community.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with, as you just heard there, Dr. Alessandra Hirsch, who's a resident in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Chicago Medical Center. Dr. Catherine Lee is a biological anthropologist and postdoc scholar in the Division of Public Health Sciences at Washington University School of Medicine. And Dr. Kate Clancy is a human reproductive ecologist and associate professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois. 800-222-9455 is the number to call. 800-222-9455. If you want to join our conversation, you can also tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. Dr. Hirsch, what could be causing menstrual changes from a medical standpoint?
The truth is that we don't know. In order to create a study where you could get closer to that information, you'd have to give 50% of people the vaccine and 50% not the vaccine, and then see how their menses changed. And so far, we don't have a study that does that. You know, there are a lot of different things that can affect someone's menstruation, including weight and stress, various medications. I think in the past, we haven't seen that vaccines have caused changes in the menstrual cycle. But again, I don't believe that that's been studied. So the honest truth is that we're not sure.
Interesting. Dr. Clancy, can you talk a little bit more about how you went about conducting this research? And, you know, I guess, and maybe it's not even the right way to think of it since it was, you know, getting people to report, but I wonder how you control for the idea that the changes in menstrual cycle were related to the vaccine and not some other factor, you know, such as diet or exercise or whatever else stress may be happening in people's lives.
Sure. I want to first start by saying that we do actually know quite a bit about how immune function operates and how it affects the uterus. And in fact, prior to this survey, I have published multiple papers on this. This is actually my area of expertise. I study inflammation and how it affects menstrual cycles. So I will say that we do actually know quite a bit about how inflammatory responses and immune responses affect the uterus. That's a huge part of how we study, you know, the ways in which maternal fetal conflict can occasionally happen within the uterus. Those of us who study it also in an evolutionary context, that's a big part of what we study. So we do, there are a lot of things that we can infer from that broader analysis of the uterus as an immune organ that allows us to understand this. And it was from that perspective, from the expertise that Dr. Lee and I have as experts in menstrual cycles, that led to us designing the survey the way we did. The other thing that led to the survey design the way it was, to answer your question, is that, you know, when we first started having these experiences, Dr. Lee and I both had some personal lived experience with this and some colleagues who were having some of these experiences. And in part, that's what motivated our desire to study this some more. So we, as anthropologists who believe it's really important to listen to people, developed intentionally an emergent tool, meaning it's in real time as people are having these experiences, and a mixed method approach, meaning that we have a whole bunch of open text boxes. So that would be qualitative data that we're gathering, as well as quantitative data in terms of people sort of self-reporting the extent to which they feel their period was unchanged, heavier, lighter, and more. And we also conducted asked for extensive background information, demographic information, history of various types of reproductive conditions, whether or not people had been pregnant before, had children before, and a whole bunch of other relevant questions that, again, were tied to our particular expertise around menstrual cycles and immune function. So we did not do what would be in the epidemiological field would call a randomized controlled trial, because we were at the early stage of vaccine rollout, and we did not feel it was ethical to just say, well, let's just do a control group of unvaccinated people and compare them to vaccinated people. That is a gold standard that has been pretty roundly criticized by historians of science, who do not think that that is the gold standard for all methods of data collection. And it's just one in our broader arsenal of tools of ways to understand bodies and people. So we did a very different design that, no, it is not prospective, but it's also not retrospective, right? It's looking in real time at people and their lived experiences in a way that tried to honor what they were going through in the moment at a time when we had very little information from vaccine trials as to what might be going on. And so I just want to really, you know, frame this kind of research project as one that had two goals, one of collecting appropriate biological and self-report information to give us a better idea of what was going on, to ask the question of whether this particular immune activation was causing this downstream response. But it came from the fact that we do actually have a lot of information already about immune responses in the uterus.
Okay, we are going to need to take a break here. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back. If you have questions about any of what we've been discussing, you can give us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. More to come with Dr. Kate Clancy and Dr. Catherine Lee, both PhDs who've been studying the effects on menstrual cycles of the COVID-19 vaccine, and Dr. Alessandra Hirsch, who's an obstetrics and gynecology resident at UChicago Medical Center. 800-222-9455 is the number if you have a comment or question for our guests. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about COVID-19 and the vaccines and menstruation and pregnancy. The number to join our conversation is 800-222-9455. We're speaking with Dr. Kate Clancy, who's a human reproductive ecologist, associate professor of anthropology at U of I, who has studied how environmental stressors influence periods for 20 years and is working, been working for more than a year now with Dr. Catherine Lee, a biological anthropologist and postdoc scholar in the Division of Public Health Sciences at Washington University School of Medicine, on how the COVID-19 vaccines have affected the menstrual cycles of many people who have reported back to them in their research work. We're also speaking with Dr. Alessandra Hirsch, a resident physician in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at UChicago Medical Center. Again, 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. Dr. Clancy, before the break, you mentioned the phrase jumped out to me as, I think it was the uterus as an immune organ, or maybe I might be mixing the words up there, but can you just say more about some of the biological processes at play there?
Sure. Just briefly, one of the ways that we think about the uterus as an immune organ is that it is, to some extent, kind of open to the world, right? We've got a cervix that protects us to some extent, but, you know, there are ways in which the environment outside can affect the health of the uterus. The other major thing that so therefore it has to design some ways of protecting itself from pathogens and other things, because of its exposure to the outside. One of the main ways, of course, is through fertilization and pregnancy. And so basically the uterus has to really decide, am I going to let the sperm in? Am I going to allow gamete fusion to occur? That's just one step. That's actually two steps. Then there's the step of, do I allow implantation to occur? Then there's, how deeply do I allow implantation to occur? Every single one of those is actually an immune decision that the uterus is making as to whether or not this is a safe bet or not. And so throughout human evolution, throughout the evolution of course, all sorts of placental mammals, we see this as a really major immune event. In fact, what we know is that there are certain types of reproductive conditions like preeclampsia that probably are at least partly immunologically derived. And that's actually why COVID is so dangerous to pregnancy, and why COVID vaccination is so important to it, is that, if you are going to have, a major pathogenic event happen during pregnancy, that's going to have really significant downstream implications for, that pregnant person as well as for the fetus.
You know, I think this is a good opportunity as well. One of the pushbacks last, I think it was last April, we had you on to talk about this subject in an earlier phase of your research on this. And we got some pushback afterwards who said we were one person who accused us of spreading vaccine misinformation and discouraging vaccination. And I want to be clear, that's not what you're saying here, right? Yeah, I mean, vaccines are very important, especially if someone's going to get pregnant, because it's a particularly vulnerable state, right?
Absolutely. I am triple vaccinated. I will be quadruple vaccinated. I will take as many boosters as I need to. And as soon as it's available for my four-year-old, my four-year-old will also be getting the vaccine. That's not the point we're making. What's really challenging here, and Dr. Lee can attest to this too, is that when it comes to understanding the lived experience of menstruating people, of birthing people, the way that we interact with the healthcare system has been challenged through many of our lives. Many of us have negative experiences, experiences of medical betrayal, experiences of being distrusted when we report our symptoms, of being mocked for our symptoms, of being misdiagnosed. And unfortunately, what that does is creates a broader level of mistrust that sometimes makes it hard and makes it so that it appears that, you know, some of the points we're trying to make about systemic failures of medicine can mistakenly be placed on individual doctors, which is not the goal, or can be on individual life-saving technologies like vaccines. Instead, what we're trying to say is, why was the system designed in such a way that it is so hard for menstruating people, birthing people, and so many other marginalized populations to be adequately treated and to have their needs met during the design process for different types of treatments?
Dr. Lee, do you want to say more on that?
Yeah, I think another thing that is really important and is difficult to talk about with nuance is that when we're talking about people experiencing a change, for those who do, in their menstrual cycle or an episode of breakthrough bleeding when they normally don't menstruate, people who do experience these things are often not meeting what would be considered a clinically relevant level of disturbance to a menstrual cycle, right? So a lot of times there's these clinical thresholds for you must be bleeding X amount of milliliters for it to be considered heavy bleeding. And for the most part, what we're capturing is people who are reporting things that are different than what they would normally experience. And I think there's this huge gap when we think about people who menstruate, being able to say, hey, this happened to my body and it was unusual and I'm a little concerned, and being able to figure out what is going on in exactly the same way that after vaccines, tons of people had headaches or fatigue. And we didn't say, oh no, your head's going to explode, or oh no, like you will be fatigued for the rest of your life. What we have is a very well-known and well-characterized immune response that we know vaccines can kick off that causes things like headache or fatigue or fever. And we just don't know if that's true around changes in menstruation because it hasn't been studied. It hasn't been part of the conversation. And we are so worried about what the clinical threshold is for major changes to a menstrual cycle that people should seek care if they are meeting those standards, that we miss that people become concerned when their body deviates from what's normal to them. So I think being aware that change can happen without it necessarily meeting that threshold, and that people should not be shut down for reporting those changes because they are not large enough, or because we want to be so concerned with reassuring people about it not affecting fertility, which it does not. The vaccine does not affect fertility, as Dr. Hirsch mentioned. That is so well established. However, we need to meet people where they are so that they feel heard when they are experiencing these changes.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, anecdotally, I'm vaxxed and boosted, and I definitely had a headache and fatigue and felt pretty terrible after the second shot and a little less so after the third shot. But I see your point. It didn't necessarily rise to something where I sought medical treatment, but still worth acknowledging if I, you know, was somebody who menstruated who had those symptoms. I definitely hear what you're saying there. Dr. Hirsch, let me ask you about people who are pregnant and hospitalized for COVID, either for the illness or for their labor and delivery. I understand that the COVID net data from 2021 showed about 97% of those people were unvaccinated. Can you just talk about why it's especially important for somebody to get vaccinated when pregnant or before pregnancy?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our current data shows that 40% of women, it says as of this January, 40% of pregnant women are vaccinated for against COVID, which is, of course, not enough. We know that women who are symptomatic with COVID-19, pregnant women who are symptomatic with COVID-19 fare worse than those who are not pregnant. And when I say worse, I mean an increased risk of ICU admission, an increased risk of needing a ventilator, and an increased risk of death. If you are a pregnant person with COVID and you have other medical problems like obesity or asthma, those risks are even higher. And it's worse still if you are a pregnant person who has been historically mistreated by the medical community, by which I mean people of color. We know that those populations have disproportionate infection rates and death rates when they are infected with COVID. So it is incredibly important to get vaccinated if you are really anyone, but if you are pregnant or thinking of becoming pregnant, vaccines are a normal part of pre-pregnancy and pregnancy-related care. We get our Tdap vaccine and we get our flu vaccines when we're pregnant. And so this should just be considered another one of those vaccines. I know that a lot of my pregnant patients come in and they are concerned, not even so much for themselves, but for their pregnancies. They don't want to take anything that could harm their pregnancies. And, you know, a lot of them are coming from sort of what Dr. Clancy and Dr. Lee were talking about, this place of historically being mistreated and ignored by the medical community. And so it's so important. I just want to reiterate what Dr. Lee is saying. It's so important to honor where they are coming from in their lives and their experiences with the medical community. You know, it's my responsibility as a physician, yes, to encourage them to get vaccinated, but it's also my responsibility as a physician to understand where they're coming from and how they relate to medicine in this experience. And I just want to say that I try to honor that with each of my patients. And I think that hopefully medicine in general is having a sort of comeuppance as we interact with these people and women who are hesitant for, in many ways, the right reasons in terms of their personal histories.
Sure, from their perspective. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. I want to go now to line four. Cindy is calling from Champaign. Cindy, thank you for calling in.
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wanted to send a message of support and interest for this show. Me and my adult daughters had some menstrual side effects from the vaccine. We believe it was from the vaccine, and especially after seeing some of your research shared through friends on Facebook. So wanted to say thanks. And we have been meted with quite a bit of skeptical looks from some of our friends who say, oh, yeah, really? You know, you're being an anti-vaxxer. And I'm totally not. I'm so supportive of vaccines, but we definitely had those side effects. And so thank you for looking into that. We appreciate it.
All right, Cindy, thank you for the call. Dr. Lee, I wonder if you want to mention that, you know, your skeptical looks from Cindy when she describes what she experienced to friends. Have you had that experience writ large with the research?
I think it's pretty common for a lot of people who participated in our research. We are in the process of going through all of the qualitative data. And one of the things that we are following up with in our follow-up survey is what happened when people told people, when someone told another person, whether it was a doctor or family or member or friend, about whether they noticed a menstrual change. And, you know, some people found solidarity. That was my experience personally. Which is one reason why we started this research. But I think a lot of other people are afraid to mention it because they don't want to be considered an anti-vaxxer. And we've definitely heard that from people in our survey as well, that they didn't want to bring this up to friends. They didn't want to tell their doctor. They didn't want to go public or whatever around it, because they know the vaccines are important and they really didn't want to scare people off for something that was, you know, a small inconvenience for them at that point. But I also want to highlight there are a lot of people for whom these changes can be really scary, especially when we're talking about people who normally don't menstruate, where it can be a sign of other larger underlying conditions and requires follow-up testing.
Dr. Clancy, I want to ask you one of the bigger questions you alluded to earlier, which is why this wasn't studied as part of the initial round of clinical trials. And that's sort of the, I think, the big picture, you know, question that your research is driving at, right? What do you know about that? What do you think about that? And what needs to change in the future?
Sure. So, you know, a historian who studies vaccine hesitancy and just the history of the exclusion of women and pregnant people from drug treatment and vaccine trials can probably speak to this better. But briefly, to my understanding, obviously, I'm on the menstrual cycle expertise side of this, and our vaccine expertise is growing. But my understanding is that the majority of the time, and this was confirmed when I spoke to someone who was involved in one of the drug treatment trials of one of the major vaccines here in the US, is that vaccine trials will ask you your last menstrual period. And then they will ask if you, and in some cases, I believe, require that you go on hormonal contraceptives in order to avoid getting pregnant. And so, you know, between those two things, asking only last menstrual period, but not subsequent periods or period experiences, and actually requiring hormonal contraceptives means that a lot of cycle effects run the risk of being masked. And what that also does is it tells a bigger picture of what the actual value is of the vaccine trial, which is what they are saying is, we don't particularly care what your experience is, we care about protecting a potential fetus. And so what it does yet again is it tells people who could be pregnant that it's not their health or their bodies that matter, it's the potential health of some potential fetus in the future.
Interesting. Dr. Hirsch, just a couple of minutes left in our conversation. There was another recent study I wanted to ask you about, speaking of fertility, since that is such a big concern that people have about the vaccine. There was a recent study that showed although vaccines don't impair fertility in men or women, a COVID infection could potentially affect a man's fertility for up to 60 days. Let me say that with a different emphasis. A COVID infection, not a vaccine, but an infection with COVID, could affect a man's fertility for up to 60 days. Some are linking it to the potential presence of a fever. More research is needed. I wonder if you can just briefly, we're almost out of time, talk about what might be happening there and you know, whether that might be affecting women in the menstrual cycle as well.
Thanks. You know, I have to confess, I am certainly not an expert in men's reproductive health. So I am not sure that I could tell you what I think is going on with that, except that I am sure that any immune response could have an effect on fertility, and certainly a fever could. But beyond that, I have to be honest, I'm not sure what's happening.
No, that's fair enough, and we appreciate
the
that honesty. You know, unfortunately, I think we're just about out of time. So I want to thank my guests, Dr. Alessandra Hirsch from UChicago Medical Center. She's a resident physician in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology there. Dr. Catherine Lee is a biological anthropologist and a postdoc scholar in the Division of Public Health Sciences at Washington University School of Medicine. And Dr. Kate Clancy is a human reproductive ecologist, associate professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois. Thank you all so much for being with us to talk about this today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking with the proprietors of the revived Born Again Labor Museum in Southern Illinois. Stay with us.